Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Vatican that is currently the subject of unprecedented and uncritical media attention in what amounts to a public relations bonanza for a scandal-plagued church, as the world press breathlessly focuses on what color smoke is coming out of a chimney. Barbara Crissett, who covers the United Nations for The Nation and was the New York Times bureau chief at the UN, joins us to discuss what the Vatican is up to at the UN, joining with Iran and Russia to thwart efforts by the Commission on the Status of Women to protect women from violence and rape, arguing that traditional values justify violations of basic human rights. Then we'll look into two important confirmation hearings before the Senate Banking Committee today on Richard Cordray to head up the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and Mary Jo White to head up the SEC. Lisa Gilbert, the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, joins us to discuss today's hearings, where Senator Elizabeth Warren blasted her Republican colleagues for doing the bidding of big banks at the expense of regular people who have been cheated on mortgages, credit cards, and student loans. Then finally, we'll speak with Dr. Gary Bennett, a professor of psychology, global health and medicine at Duke University, about Mayor Bloomberg's ban on big sugary drinks set to go into effect in New York today that was blocked by a judge. We'll look into whether this is a victory for big business over big government and whether efforts to curtail the epidemic of obesity have been damaged by an apparent victory in the name of personal freedom of corporate profits over people's health. Joining us now is Barbara Crissett, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times' chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. In 2010 and 2011, Ms. Crissett reported and wrote the State of World Population Report for the United Nations Population Fund, the first focused on women in post-conflict areas and the second on the world at 7 billion. She has an article at thenation.com, at the UN, 20 years of backlash to women's rights are human rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Crissett.
Thank you.
And the UN's Commission on the Status of Women seems to have been stalled now, and the final communique may not happen, and fingers are being pointed at the Vatican, Iran, and Russia for trying to essentially, in the name of traditions, essentially, justify violations of human rights in the name of traditional values. So, is that what's going on?
Well, it's partly what's going on, and I've just looked at the latest NGO reports today because they're watching this obviously very carefully. Women's advocacy groups, all sorts of other people, and some governments. It's in Africa that there seems to be some resistance on the question of tradition and culture, most clearly. But also, Africa has now joined this sort of front that the countries you mentioned, Russia, Iran, there's some smaller countries, Bangladesh and others, that have been in and out and involved in this, and some other countries from the Middle East, Saudis, I think you mentioned. But anyway, there are two issues. It's the culture and tradition, but this other issue, which is now kind of bubbling up to the surface, is the question of whether or not this document, this communique that you, as you describe, when it's supposed to come out at the end of this week, but it's not looking good at the moment, whether it mentions that the Security Council resolutions, a pile of them now, starting in 2000, have demanded that countries treat women better in conflict areas. That, as you know, rape is a huge problem in internal conflicts, civil wars, and so on. And in the post-conflict period, women get denied places at the peace table. They are going to have to rebuild the societies. Many of the men are often killed, and they are simply sidelined or completely ignored. So it's these two things coming together, and that is kind of making a very unholy alliance. I know this is a longer explanation than you need, but it's the kind of thing that happens at the UN, completely ignoring the huge problems women face around the world.
But how can you ignore the fact that there is a global epidemic of gender-based violence. The World Bank reports estimates that more women between the ages of 15 and 44 are at risk of rape and domestic violence than from cancer, car accidents, war, and malaria combined, and that more than 600 million women live in countries where domestic violence is not considered a crime.
Correct. And, you know, the hypocrisy in much of this is that when the great conferences on women in the 1990s, particularly the population conference in Cairo, which said women should have control over their own bodies, states should not set population quotas, there should be no forced abortions and things like that, but there should also not be any pressure on women in making up their own minds. If they want to have six or seven children and they can afford it, fine. That was population in Cairo, and also in there was implicit that people had the right to safe abortions, which the UN Population Fund supports. And then the Conference on Women in Beijing in 1995, which really reinforced and strengthened all these human rights, women's rights or human rights ideas, these are now what are basically under attack, and a lot of countries signed on to these, or you know, agreed to these agreements in 1994 and 1995, and then suddenly the backlash started when everybody realized what they had signed up to, and it's been a downhill struggle ever since.
But Barbara Crosette, what I don't understand is, particularly at this moment where the Vatican, as I mentioned in the opening, is getting extraordinary free press. It's a public relations bonanza. The entire, you cannot turn on television without hours of coverage of people standing there with clerical collars in St. Peter's Square, speculating about what kind of smoke's going to come out of a chimney. And it goes on and on and on. And we know that the 115 cardinals, all of them have been chosen by either this pope or his predecessor. So they're all arch-conservatives. There is no story here about what's happening, except that we're going to have business as usual and an incredibly conservative pope. Yet it is being treated like a great cliffhanger. And it's breathtaking, at the sort of breathless nature of the concentration on unbelievable trivia. But that is what we have, and here we are talking about something that nobody's talking about, and that is what the Vatican's doing at the United Nations, where it has a seat, and how so often it is in joining forces with the most reactionary regimes, in particular, in this case, Iran and Russia, but also in prior cases, Saudi Arabia and other countries, where it has common cause with these dark regimes. So I don't understand why this connection's not being made to about what's happening in Rome, picking a new pope, and what the Vatican really stands for in front of the world body.
You're absolutely right. I mean, there's no, even in this hyped coverage tonight. I heard the ABC anchor say the whole world is watching. You know, if I were an editor at this point, I'd send a reporter across town to the other side of Rome to a cafe and see how many people are talking about this. My suspicion is that the people who are watching are the TV people. It's also American provincialism. To a degree that he sees on a story and make it a historic moment, they're calling it. No effort to remind the viewers and the readers of the swamp of scandals that these cardinals have waded through to get here. And the kind of things that almost every one of them has some kind of a problem in his background. This is all forgotten. I mean, the best newspapers have obviously reported on the background of these people, but it's astonishing how the whole world kind of the whole world's media, or at least American media, and as I was telling you earlier when we were talking, even the BBC outdid itself this morning with fawning coverage of what was going on in the Vatican. You know, in a way, you can see that if we're getting back to the issue of women's rights and violence against women, the cardinals, in many ways, have more in common with the mullahs and the imams who are anti-women than they do with the women who are in the Catholic Church.
Well, I've spoken to Sister Simone Campbell and others, and they would agree with you. They don't say it, but they basically are being harassed, and by this particular pope, the one that just resigned, who felt that they were preaching radical feminism instead of being opposed to abortion and sticking to the church doctrine. So there is a war within the Catholic Church against women and the ordination of women too. But this is what's going on at the UN, though, is I think escaping a lot of people's scrutiny. And you know what a country does at the UN is it reflects what that country stands for. That's what it's about. It's about representing, and for reasons which I don't think we need to get into, the Vatican has a seat. So I think it's worth noting what the Vatican stands for in front of the world body.
Yes, but we come back to the American media. By the time I left the UN job in 2001, 2002.
New York Times, you mean?
Yeah, for being the bureau chief at the UN, the percentage of media organizations in the U.S. had dwindled to close to zero who were keeping their correspondence there. The American media is not interested in the UN and doesn't cover the UN for the most part. It's a distressing thing because that means that no one ever hears the kind of things that are going on. I mean, some of the incredible people who have been gathered in New York, the Commission on the Status of Women, which is meeting, has been meeting since 1946. It's an annual commission that's supposed to set policy on women. This year, the issue is violence against women for the reasons you mentioned. The data isn't even complete, but what people know is pretty awful. So, but nobody is covering this. From the major media organizations, most of the information is coming from NGOs and others who get scraps of information, and occasional pieces put out by missions or some governments. You know, are much more plugged into this and making more of it, and there's more coverage probably in the Nordic countries, maybe the Netherlands and places like that. But it's what Americans don't know about, they don't know what to think about. And that's been the problem with lots of things in the UN, including how we got into a war in Iraq.
What is not being reported, and I know you spend a lot of time at the United Nations, is who's lobbying there. I mean, not just the idea that the Vatican and Iran and Russia are working together against women's rights in the name of arguing that traditional values justify violations of human rights. You have apparently roaming the corridors. You've got these zealous people you're showing pictures of aborted fetuses and this kind of stuff. Tell me about some of these groups. Like Austin Roos of the Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute. I mean, in other words, it seems to me that there's an awful lot of lobbying going on there that escapes the attention of most people, and it doesn't really represent the broader swath of American public opinion.
No, it doesn't. There are many NGOs, of course, who do, and they're from all over the world. But the Catholic, they call themselves CFAM, you know, the Catholics and Human Rights, Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute, is very conservative. And they and some various evangelical Protestant sects and other people have focused almost entirely on abortion, but there are other issues. They're against lesbian and gay and other rights for LGBT people, BT people. They are they're against, obviously, gay marriage. They're against a lot of other things. They think that, you know, a huge conspiracy of feminists and others are out to change the way families are defined, which is an issue here, as you know. But this focus on abortion has allowed them to, you know, pick up support in other places, and you know they're quite good. In 2000, a woman who's a researcher at a university in Canada wrote a very good report on these. This was when the backlash was, you know, you could feel the wave rising against the 1994-95 conferences about, you know, parsing these crowds and seeing who they were and where they're coming from. And you know, she said there are lots of American fundamentalists in this. But also, several years ago, I did an article for a magazine on Eastern Europe, on Poland in particular, for Conscience magazine. And you could see there that there were also very much in line, these conservative Catholics were very much in line with the kind of thing that CFAM is doing. And in Poland, they had all heard of CFAM. And that is the conservative Catholics. And this was a reaction against communism. In other words, you know, there was a lot of context here, which again, you know, is not reported so much. And so a lot of people don't really understand that this issue is bigger than just whether or not abortion is legal. And also why the UN stands behind safe abortion, and because lots of people are dying in the third world of botched abortions. And so, I mean, this is supposed to be a development issue, but they won't allow that to happen. This lobby wants to keep it as some sort of high moral tone issue. And as you suggested earlier, to do this in the face of the gathering of cardinals, some of whom come from, you know, areas where there have been huge abuses of boys, women, men, and everybody else, is beyond belief.
But how do they, the Vatican, for example, I understand Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia's role in this is a little bit hard to follow, but how do the Vatican justify not wanting to protect women from violence and rape?
Entirely. I mean, you know, I'm obviously not in that on that wavelength, but as I have read it and see it and hear about it, it's entirely on what is right and wrong. It's moral. It's their perception of moral grounds, and it's their belief, and that's fine. And they're entitled to their beliefs, but being entitled to that belief doesn't necessarily mean shooting doctors who perform abortion, cutting off all aid to developing countries where abortions are performed in order to save lives, because there isn't enough contraception, which also many of these groups have fought against the U.S. supplying through U.S. aid. And so, you know, it's an issue in their hearts and heads, but it's an issue that doesn't reflect the real world, and the real world doesn't have the luxury of some of these beliefs, you know, in the way that these people feel that if they believe this, that then therefore their view of the world should be the view of the world. I should add that the Catholic Bishops Conference in Washington is another interesting group to watch, because Catholics have, as you can tell from news reports, weighed in on the provision of contraception in the new universal health care, or not quite universal, but right, the president's health care plan. So, you know, they're busy from the hierarchy down to the protest groups like CFAM, lining up against things they don't believe in, which is fair enough, except that not everybody else should have to follow those rules.
Well, Barbara Cassette, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Barbara Cassette, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine and author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia, and later the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She also reported and wrote the State of World Population Reports for the United Nations Population Fund, the first focused on women in post-conflict areas and the second on the world at 7 billion. She has an article at thenation.com at the UN, 20 years of backlash to women's rights are human rights. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about today's hearings before the Senate Banking Committee, where Senator Warren really blasted her Republican colleagues. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lisa Gilbert, who's the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She's a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics and writes frequently for the Huffington Post and Think Progress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Gilbert.
Thanks so much for having me.
And these two hearings today for nominees, Richard Cordray with the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and Mary Jo White to head up the Securities and Exchange Commission before the Senate Banking Committee, it seems to me that the person who stole the show was Senator Elizabeth Warren, who didn't bother to ask questions of the witness since Richard Cordray had testified dozens of times before the panel. Instead, she turned to her Republican colleagues and absolutely blasted them for basically trying to hold up Cordray's nomination and weaken the agency itself. What was your reaction to it?
I think you have said it very well. We certainly expected a lot from Elizabeth Warren as a champion on consumer issues and on financial issues and protecting the public, and she's delivered over and over again since she started her brief tenure in the Senate. So this was no different. She came out guns blazing and absolutely took her fellow senators to task around their ridiculous refusal to move Cordray forward to head the CFPB.
So when she said to the Republican senators, the American people deserve a Congress that worries less about helping big banks and more about helping regular people who have been cheated on mortgages, on credit cards, on student loans, and on credit reports, what was the response?
I mean, I think that's correct, and we would agree. As a consumer group, I think this threatened filibuster against Director Cordray is just an attempt to weaken what has proven to be a really effective new agency. And, you know, that's a bad thing for the public. Regular people are depending on a consumer agency to be their watchdog, and it needs a head in order to move forward in its important duties.
But what did the Republicans say in response to these rather pointed questions?
Yes, I mean, they weren't really able to take it on directly. I think they settled back into what has been their objective, over the course of the year, and even ironically 2 years ago when we were looking to Elizabeth Warren to lead the agency, which is that they just don't like the structure. So they would prefer that the agency be run by a commission rather than by a single director. Citing the SEC as a model, and we would argue that that's far less effective than the current setup. They fall back on talking about the funding of the CFPB, saying that they should have the power as Congress to appropriate money to it rather than the current structure. But really, those are all just excuses. They don't want to see a CFPB in place, and they look for any opportunity to undermine it, and this was one of those.
Well, but Elizabeth Warren addressed that whole, the hypocrisy or the hollow nature of her Republican colleagues' objections to the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau and wanting to be able to control its budget and have a commission instead of an agency. She said, "What I want to know is why, since the 1980s, have there been agencies all over Washington with a single director, including the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency? But unlike the consumer agency, no one in the U.S. Senate has held up confirmation of their directors demanding that the agency be redesigned. What I want to know is why every banking regulator since the Civil War has been funded outside the appropriations process. But unlike the consumer agency, no one in the U.S. Senate has held up confirmation of their directors demanding that agency or those agencies be redesigned. And what I want to know is why there are agencies all over Washington whose rules are final subject to ordinary reviews and oversights, while the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau is the only agency in government subject to a veto by another agency. But unlike the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, no one in the U.S. Senate holds up confirmation of their directors demanding that those agencies be redesigned." So, boy, I mean, she lays it out. Again, what's their response?
I mean, she's very clear, and they don't really have one. And I think that's the bottom line. I mean, she is pointing out that this is political posturing, that there is no reason this agency has been successful. Its structure is not unique, and it's necessary to protect the public. And what they're doing is a political joke. And so they don't really have anything to say that's legitimate. And so, you know, I can parrot back to you the excuses that they make, but the bottom line is
accountable. I certainly don't. It's bad enough hearing it for the first once, let alone hearing it again. Because it is so hollow. But I was just interested in whether you can shame these people or whether they are shameless, because they seem to be shameless, excuse my language, whores for the banking industry.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think so whether or not they're able to be shamed is certainly an open question. I think one thing we have on our side is that this time, this filibuster of any nominee to run the agency is even more hollow than it was before, because Cordray has been in place for a year. And, you know, across the spectrum, you know, both sides of the aisle and the regulated entities, the banks themselves, have said that he's done a good job, that he was balanced, that he took into account public opinion and industry opinion, that he paid attention, that he, you know, did due diligence on all the rulemakings that the CFPB is doing. And so it's even more right flank for, you know, his entire nomination to be blocked. And so those points being made over and over again are helpful and hopefully, in the end, persuasive.
Now, in terms of the Republican senators who have been holding up Richard Cordray and doing everything they can to stifle this agency or literally strangle it in the cradle, there is, however, one Republican senator who said he's going to vote for it, and that is Senator Tom Coburn. He's going to vote for Cordray's nomination.
That's right. So it's not 100% party line. It's not quite enough, but yes, you know, at the hearing today, Coburn said he plans to support the nomination, which we're happy to see. And I think hopefully some of those points I was making earlier about his true qualified status, having done this job for a year, are what were persuasive to Senator Coburn and hopefully will be persuasive to others.
And did Senator Coburn explain why he was supporting Cordray and bucking the rest of his colleagues?
Not in great detail. I think, you know, Coburn has been known to go on his own path, and so it's probably a combination of that coupled with complete opposition to Cordray feels out of balance with what some of the regulated entities actually want, which is certainty.
So let's turn to the other hearing, of course, on the other nominee for the Security Exchange Commission, Mary Jo White. Oh, nobody's had a bad word to say about Cordray, except the Republicans, who haven't so much attacked him personally, but have claimed that they're really interested in trying to have this agency run better. At the same time, they want to control its budget and weaken its ability to conduct oversight. But there has been quite a bit of disquiet about Mary Jo White in the blogosphere and in lots of articles I've read, in the sense that nobody ever questions the fact that when she was a U.S. attorney, she went after drug dealers and mafia dons very successfully, but that she did work on Wall Street and that there's a kind of revolving door quality to this nomination. So how much of that came up, and how much did she satisfy those questions?
I think it came up pretty regularly. Almost every senator raised this possible conflict of interest that you're mentioning in some way or another. I think she certainly had the talking point down as to, you know, she's been cleared by the ethics process and told that her conflicts are not so much greater than former nominees to be SEC chair. You know, it's an open question. I mean, what was helpful and clarified in some ways is that she won't in any way need to recuse herself from any rulemakings, which is a good thing. But there is still the question as to what it will mean for enforcement. And since that's her known quantity, that she was such a tough AG, it's interesting to think that she might have to sit out some of those battles, and it's not a good thing.
Well, she's going to recuse herself or abstain from decisions that the SEC brought against the law firm of her husband, John White, who's the corporate attorney with Kravath, Swain, and Moore. But isn't the concern, as it is, for example, with the Pentagon revolving door and contractors and generals, et cetera, that if you've worked for big Wall Street law firms and then you move into government oversight, that people from your professional past on Wall Street, isn't that what it's all about? It's all about knowing people and therefore getting face time?
Yes. So that's sort of a different question than specific conflicts of interest.
Sure.
And we completely agree at Public Citizen that the revolving door generally is a huge problem and leads to, you know, what you're talking about, agency capture, where, you know, it's much easier for folks from industry to seek out and have conversations and have their opinions known to folks who work inside these agencies. It's very worrisome generally. What is hard to say, sadly, is whether her specific instance is so much worse than any other. But across the board, it's a huge problem.
Well, as you know, Lisa Gilbert, there's been a lot of questions raised recently. In fact, there was a very effective frontline documentary called The Untouchables about Wall Street's bankers who brought the economy to a near-death experience and almost destroyed the global economy. They were made whole by the taxpayer. Now they're bigger, stronger than ever. They're too big to fail and apparently too big to jail, according to the Attorney General in some recent testimony. And the documentary featured Lanny Brewer, the main prosecutor of Wall Street in the Justice Department, who has manifestly failed and had all kinds of excuses. So there's a lot of people out there, myself included, that are just absolutely amazed at what happened here. It feels like the fix is in, you know? And I would like to know from you whether this woman who's just been appointed to the SEC, a key position, is she tainted? Is the fix in on her? Or do you think she's going to be what's required? Somebody's got to do something somewhere, and I'm wondering who it's going to be, apart from Elizabeth Warren.
Question, and certainly something we're thinking about a lot. Too big to jail is a bad phenomenon for a number of reasons, both you know, this lack of prosecution, this deferred prosecution, which generally is a bad thing because corporate criminals should be held accountable just like any other criminal, but also the problem that it's tied into these institutions that are considered systemically too big to fail and that that could be a reason to not prosecute. So those are serious problems. The question of whether the SEC is the place to take them on is an interesting one because it's not the criminal venue. So, you know, certainly she was asked that question a number of times today, and I think you're right. I mean, people are outraged, and they should be. This what happened with HSBC was appalling. And what she said is that she would be strong and that she would, you know, do the civil penalties that the SEC can do if wrongdoing is found. But what is not answered, and I think is separate from Mary Jo White's confirmation hearing, but is what DOJ will do to change its practices, because that's where the heart of what just happened lies. And so certainly we think that it's not acceptable for prosecution to be deferred based on size.
Well, as well as DOJ, isn't the controller of the currency the person who, or the agency that should have made criminal referrals over what happened on Wall Street, and they didn't make one? I'm just curious about why criminal referrals weren't made, given the enormous amount of fraud. And by the way, the enormous amount of evidence. I mean, you talk about a paper trail. This was all about paper trails. These were phony mortgages with phony paper, boxes and reams of it. So that's the part of this whole story that I find extraordinary, is why no criminal referrals? Is it the control of the currency that dropped the ball, or the DOJ?
Yeah, and that's actually what these oversight hearings have been trying to get the bottom of. So who made the recommendation to DOJ to not proceed? Why did the OCC not hold additional hearings? Why did the FDIC continue to insure HSBC? I mean, there's guilt to go around and mysteries to dig into, because no one knows the answer, which is unfortunate. Public Citizen is actually, we're in the mix of asking the OCC to initiate a hearing to take a look at this again.
OCC being the Office of the Control of the Currency.
Exactly.
So sorry to interrupt you. You're asking the OCC to what?
Indeed. They have the authority to initiate a hearing to consider actual charter termination of institutions, at the very least start looking into the fraud that you're talking about. And so we're hopeful that they'll comply with our requests.
Again, I'm speaking with Lisa Gilbert, the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She's a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics and writes frequently for the Huffington Post and Think Progress. So what's the sense then that you have, Lisa, of going back to Richard Cordray and this embattled agency that, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me in retrospect that it's a good thing that Elizabeth Warren didn't become the first head of that agency, given that she was the one who basically call for it to come into existence in the first place. I mean, she's so much more effective as a U.S. senator, isn't she? Particularly given what happened today, where instead of putting the witness on trial, who's already been questioned and up the kazoo at any rate, she turned the tables and questioned her Republican colleagues and smoked them out on their phony posturing.
Yeah, I mean, I think she is a champion on these issues and probably would have been equally successful if she had headed the CFPB, but we're very happy to have her in the Senate. And as I said at the top, she's certainly been living up to all the expectations of what she would be like as a senator thus far.
But what do you think is going to happen? I mean, is the Republican strategy, obviously at the behest of the banking lobby, to do all they can to weaken Dodd-Frank and to prevent this agency from hitting the ground running and doing its job? I mean, that seems to be their strategy. Can they continue to do what they're doing? Is there this hearing today? I don't know what it's going to lead to. So, to your mind, what is it going to require to stop this harassment and this phony posturing? I mean, short of public shaming, and apparently the public is not sufficiently upset with the Republican senators are aware of what's going on to weigh in. So even though they appear to be shamelessly working on behalf of these huge banks, I don't know what's going to stop them. Who's going to step up to the plate here?
It's a very good question. I think what's going to happen eventually is that the good record of the CFPB will continue to speak for itself. I mean, you mentioned that Coburn has switched sides on this, and I don't think he'll be the last to do so. You know, it's unlike other battles in which the banking industry has been out in front. You know, in this particular instance, there's pretty widespread consensus that Richard Cordray has done a balanced job in this role. And so it becomes harder and harder to stand on principle. So we'll see. I mean, certainly we don't have the votes right now to confirm him, and time will tell, but we're hopeful.
And in terms of Mary Jo White, who, as I mentioned earlier, there's some skepticism about her, even though she's got a pretty stellar record as a prosecutor. Nobody has suggested that Cordray is anything but qualified and should be supported. But in her case, what's your sense of whether she's going to surprise people and be the bulldog that she was when she was in the U.S. Attorney's Office?
I mean, my hope is that she does harken back to the last time that she was in government. I mean, that is, you know, the last time we saw her serve. And as you say, to all accounts, she did a fabulous job there. So we hope to see a similar record on enforcement and on rulemaking. You know, in particular, one thing that we're working on that will be a test, we think, of where she'll come down on rules is whether she's willing to push for the important petition for rulemaking on corporate political contribution disclosure. It's a huge issue in the wake of Citizens United. There's been a petition gathering steam that the SEC agreed to take up right as Mary Shapiro, the previous chair, was leaving. So Mary Jo White steps in at a critical juncture for that rule, and we think it's a pretty important test.
And this is basically a petition that would put some transparency on corporate money flowing into politics.
Exactly. And even more important, at least from the SEC's perspective, it would give investors the ability to know whether they should keep their funds in any particular corporation or whether they should move them based on their political activities.
So that the investor in a corporation has to be told who the corporation is supporting politically. And at this point, they're not.
At this point, they are not, and we think that information really matters to investors.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today and for filling us in on these important hearings, Lisa Gilbert.
Of course. Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with Lisa Gilbert, who's director of Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She's a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics and writes frequently for The Huffington Post and Think Progress. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the overturning of the ban on big sugary drinks and its implication for obesity and public health.
mountain with the barkers and the colored balloons. You can't be 20 on Sugar Mountain, though you're thinking that you're leaving there too soon. You're leaving there too soon.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Gary Bennett, who's a professor of psychology, global health, and medicine at Duke University, where he directs the Duke Obesity Prevention Program and co-directs the Duke Center on Biobehavioral Health Disparities Research. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Gary Bennett.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And the mayor of New York, of course, has gone through something of a public humiliation since he banned the big sugary soda drinks, and then a judge overturned that ban. So how do you see this? Is this a victory of big business over big government?
Well, I think it's probably a bit premature to call a victory for either side at this point. You know, our primary concern here is that we don't think the original measure really went quite far enough. And my concern is that the mayor and those of us who are interested in policy strategies to contend with the obesity epidemic really may have spent too much political capital on this initiative that we think probably was unlikely to make a major dent in obesity rates anyway.
Well, but wasn't there a statewide effort to ban or to bring in a soda tax, I should say, and that got clobbered by the big food lobby?
Yeah, indeed it did. You know, unfortunately, though, when we look at the kinds of policy solutions that are most likely to make an impact on the weight of the community, it really is nothing like the surcharges for sugary beverages. The kind of initiative that the mayor advocated was a good measure, but probably best included as part of a comprehensive package of policy strategies. On its own, I think it was probably unlikely to make a major impact. And as I said, you know, we really need popular support and strong political support for these kinds of initiatives. And I'm afraid that after all that's happened with the New York proposal, we may have a lost ground on that.
Well, there were, of course, some inconsistencies in the ban, not to justify the judge's ruling, because it seemed to be all over the place in some parts, suggesting that the ban wasn't strict enough, and then in other parts of this poorly written argument by Judge Tingling that it was hurting business, as though Coca-Cola and companies like that are on the ropes. But the fact that milkshakes are okay, you know, you can still go to the 7-Eleven and get the massive 64-ounce infusion of sugar because that's regulated by the state, not the city, et cetera. So it seemed to me that there were some serious flaws, shall we say, in the mayor's proposal.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I think that the food industry's argument, just to start with, was specious at best. You know, we heard the same kind of thing from the tobacco lobby years ago, that businesses were going to be harmed, that the industry was going to be harmed. And really, I think that was not true, was not the case. And I think it's quite unlikely that the industry's position was really a valid one in this regard as well. But you know, just to reflect on your point a bit, the value of a measure like this, I think, is primarily to change the way that people think about their beverage consumption. And the real value is in changing what we call social norms, or, you know, the kinds of attitudes and perspectives that people have on their food consumption behaviors. And unfortunately, though, I think you're right that the measure itself in practice was going to be rather confusing. You know, there were some things that were in and some things that were out and some things that were regulated by some parties and others not. And, you know, some days you could have a coffee drink and couldn't have a soda. You know, so I think that my concern really was that in practice, the confusion caused by the ban, in many respects, acted against its potential in changing the population's norms. And look, I applaud Mayor Bloomberg for taking this on. He has been an advocate for public health for a long time, and I know his heart's in the right place. I just think that this measure was probably not the right one as the first big initiative in the obesity policy space.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Gary Bantich, who's a professor of psychology, global health, and medicine at Duke University, where he directs the Duke Obesity Prevention Program and co-directs the Duke Center on Biobehavioral Health Disparities Research. So in terms of biobehavioral health disparities research, not that I'm anything of an expert. In fact, it's the first time I've heard the term, but
it doesn't exactly ring off the tongue.
Exactly. But in terms of disparities, at least, the issue is, it seems so much tied to poverty. And it is the most obese people in this country tend to be poor or lowly paid, single mothers with a bunch of kids that they've got to feed, sometimes on food stamps, and the sugary, fat-laden, salt-laden corporate food goes further and gives the family the illusion of nutrition and sustenance. Isn't that the heart of the problem?
It's certainly a major contributor to the problem. There's no question about it. Right now, the most palatable foods that are in ready supply are inexpensive, and they happen to be those that are most processed and most energy dense. And that's a real problem. You know, the kinds of foods that we know to be associated with normal weight and weight loss, leafy vegetables, fruits, those kinds of foods, are rather expensive. They remain expensive, and they're just plain not as accessible to the most socioeconomically disadvantaged people in our society. And that's a major concern and a major contributor to the obesity epidemic. So, you know, one of our concerns about the measure, the New York measure, is that we like when we have policies that restrict access, like the soda ban, we like to pair those with measures that make healthful choices easy for people to make. And that actually was a major concern with the ban. It would have been, as part of a comprehensive package of policy solutions, perhaps a set of policies that might have resulted in incentivizing more healthful foods or lowering prices or adding additional incentives to retailers to make more widely available healthful foods. This kind of policy would make sense. But again, on its own, restricting access has the potential of being unnecessarily regressive and actually harming those at the lowest ends of the socioeconomic spectrum.
So, Dr. Gary Bantich, what can be done, though, in terms of grassroots political organization to counter the power and wealth of the corporate food industry? And if you just go back to the statewide soda ban that was literally hammered into extinction by big companies like Coca-Cola. For example, they got the NAACP to endorse their efforts in spite of the fact that African Americans have a higher rate than average of obesity. So isn't this, I mean, at least it leads me to see that the playing field's not level in terms of propaganda, information, public relations, you name it, education, whatever you want to call it. The food industry has got a bigger megaphone.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the incentives are misaligned right now. We know that the food industry are major donors to many of the civic and non-governmental and advocacy organizations that lobby on behalf of the very folks who are most disproportionately affected by obesity. And so I think really what we need to see more frequently is public advocacy and really public clamoring for advocacy organizations to strike a harder bargain with the food industry. I mean, you're very right about the NAACP and other organizations. And in fact, in many respects, they are in a very well positioned to make these kinds of arguments on behalf of the communities that they serve. And so I think really we need to see more public clamoring for this kind of thing. You know, it's also the case that consumer demand really matters. And you know, I think we have underestimated the impact of consumer demand on changing industry practices. You know, if I asked you 15 years ago how many different brands of organic milk were you able to find in your local supermarket, you'd probably tell me none, and maybe one. But now you'll have 3, 4, or 5 different brands of organic milk alone, and that's a function of increased public demand, consumer demand for those kinds of products. We need to see the very same thing for healthful products being made more widely available in supermarkets across the country. And what's even more important is that we see public We see public advocacy activity on behalf of increasing access to healthful foods and ensuring that supermarkets are full-service supermarkets are widely accessible by the populations who are socioeconomically disadvantaged. You can look at organizations like the Food Trust in Pennsylvania, which has as part of its mission increasing access to full-service supermarkets in low-income areas throughout Pennsylvania. It's been a hugely successful initiative, public-private partnerships, lots of involvement from the academic research community, and they're really making a difference. We need to see more initiatives like that. And if we did, I think we'd be able to see change in the weight of the communities that are really most affected.
So, Dr. Gary Bennett, the big food corporations, apparently their profits are in the trillions and per year. And there's a book out I interviewed recently, Michael Moss, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author. I think it's called Salt, Sugar, Fat.
Right.
And he describes how back in, I think, 1999, the CEOs of all the big food corporations met at Pillsbury headquarters and were given a briefing about how their food is responsible for the obesity epidemic. And rather than deal with it honestly, they came up with all kinds of ways to take fat out, to put sugar in, to relabel, etc. So it seems to me that if the public realized how much the epidemic of obesity actually costs them in terms of medical costs because of the costs of obesity and diabetes and heart disease, you can look at the figures. I mean, trillions of profit for the food industry, and I believe obesity and diabetes, I think the costs are about $600 billion a year, most of which is borne ultimately by the taxpayer. So isn't that a way for the average American to recognize they've got a dog in this fight?
Absolutely. Look, you know, with all the discussion in D.C. right now about spending and cost-cutting measures and the like, you know, our obesity epidemic is a non-trivial contributor to our rising healthcare costs. There's really no question about it. And if we look at the primary drivers of obesity in American society anyway, there's really no question that the widespread availability of processed foods and foods consumed away from home, you know, also called fast food, are major drivers of our obesity epidemic. There's just really no question about that. I don't think there's any credible, really no credible evidence to the contrary. So, yes, it's definitely the case that our interest in having easily accessible fat-laden, sugar-laden foods are both causing our waistlines to increase, but they're also costing us money, and they're going to continue to cost us money. You know, my concern really is that they will continue to negatively impact our productivity in this country, decrease our military readiness, I mean, and continue to cost us money in ways that are really quite unexpected. You know, continuing to cost us more money at the pumps and more money on our airplane tickets because of the gas charges. And there are a whole host of costs, both direct and indirect, and hidden and not so hidden, that are directly related to our increasing waistlines. So I think this is a major societal problem and really a crisis, and it does require us to each take stock of what we're eating and how we're eating and to think about the long-term consequences both to our health and to our nation.
So, Dr. Gary Bennett, then, how much of this is in terms of Mayor Bloomberg and his defeat by the state judge, who's apparently running for re-election, and of course Mayor Bloomberg is almost, his tenure's almost up. Is it a case of the wrong messenger in as much as, you know, you've got a billionaire who's sort of lecturing to a bunch of poor people who simply, you know, don't have the education or the financial wherewithal to make the right choices? Is there a possibility of a better spokesperson, of somebody that can really engage the victims of this bad diet that corporate America is foisting on them?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the example of Mayor Bloomberg, you know, for those of us in the public health community, Mayor Bloomberg has long been known as a really vocal advocate and proponent for public health concerns. And he's done so at times when public health really was not particularly an attractive area in which to invest. So I think that Mayor Bloomberg has an appropriate, as I said before, his heart's in the right place, and his has a bully pulpit in a big way as a third-term mayor who is a billionaire and is probably unabashed in many respects. That said, the obesity epidemic is too big and too intractable and too linked to too many different parts of American society for us to have and just one spokesperson. And so it's going to take efforts from the First Lady and from Mayor Bloomberg and from civic actors and from researchers. It's going to take more spokespeople for this kind of, for us to win this battle. You know, if we look back at our efforts to combat the tobacco industry, there were lots. That was a long marathon battle, and there were lots of ups and downs, and many times in that looked just like this one, when individual jurisdictions and individual judges turned down different actions that municipalities were interested in enacting. And so I think that the obesity policy strategies will live to fight another day. My hope is that this will become a more of a broad-based effort, and that we'll see more communities take on initiatives like this. If you, again, use the tobacco control as an example, what really we all believe that tobacco control policies were directly related to the decrease in smoking in this country. But we got there because municipalities across the country, communities all across our nation, argued for tobacco bans, and we're still seeing those today. So my hope is that we'll have some more inspired policy solutions, perhaps by smaller communities that are disproportionately affected by obesity, that will begin to pass this kind of legislation so that it becomes normative. Starting in New York is potentially a good idea, but again, I think it's really going to have to happen across the country for us to make a major dent in the obesity epidemic.
Well, Dr. Gary Bennett, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your interest.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Gary Bennett, who is a professor of psychology, global health, and medicine at Duke University, where he directs the Duke Obesity Prevention Program and co-directs the Duke Center on Biobehavioral Health Disparities Research. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.